We go deep on the trade that sent Pascal Siakam to the Pacers, and then we hand out some midseason awards. That and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to another edition of No Cap Room here on the Ball Don't Lie podcast feed. My name is Jake Fisher. I am the senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. Joining me as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports, it is my man, your man, everyone's man, Dan Devine. What is up?
Jake Fisher, what is up is Pascal Siakam is now a member of the Indiana Pacers. And as a result of that, I am like several hours behind on writing a big thing for tomorrow. But that's okay. We're going to make it up. We got an early start on the podcast for Thursday. We're going to get a lot of writing done. Going to get a lot of talking done. Here we fucking go.
Here we fucking go. I dodged, I think, this is my theory. I dodged the post-Pascal trade reaction writing because I snuck in a little notebook like right before it happened.
So yes,
thank
you
for the Pacers and the Raptors for giving my story about 3 hours of shelf life, where we'll get into that in a little bit. We're going to do the thing we hate doing later on, talk about awards. Because we're roughly midway through the NBA season, and then we'll recap some Pascal stuff, some other leftover trade tidbits, because we know that's what the aggregators are looking for. but first, definitely wanted to take a moment to send our regards to the Golden State franchise for what seems to be like a truly harrowing event for everyone involved, let alone the tragic death of assistant coach Dejan Miljovic, who was 46, had a heart attack at a team dinner earlier this week and passed away yesterday, Wednesday, in the like aftermath of the Pascal situation. Like, that's not how it happened, but that's how like the NBA world responded to it or heard it and felt it. And, just definitely seems like he was someone who touched a lot of people in global basketball, not just for his abilities on the court as a player and as a coach, but as just like a really good, solid guy who brought a lot of positivity and energy to everyone he touched. And from like a organizational standpoint, Dejan was one of the additions that Golden State made on Steve Kerr's staff after the pretty dreadful 2021 season. That was James Wiseman's rookie year, and they flipped out a lot of the player development guys, some front of the bench people, if I recall correctly, had to go. And he, after helping shape Nikola Jokic's rise in his youth ball at Mega, was definitely tasked with helping work with James Wiseman and whatnot, and has been a member of that team ever since, and a beloved member of that team ever since. So very, very sad development, and something that makes you think about talking to your loved ones a little bit more and whatnot. Sure. So Dan, any other thoughts on this before we get back to the fun stuff?
Yeah, it's obviously, I mean, these are horrible circumstances in which to learn about more about somebody that you didn't know about. But there are often you get these wonderful remembrances that people offer about the ones who have left us behind. And our friend Katie Heindel, who had come on Divine Intervention earlier in the season, she spoke to Coach Miljovic for a piece she wrote on Wiseman back in 2021, and she shared something from that on Wednesday, where he had said, quote, there's some things you can work on with every player, but every player has his own package or is better at something and not great at something else. You have to recognize this. That's my talent, being able to recognize what somebody can do. And a lot of the remembrances that you're getting from people, like as a Serbian, he was a legendary Serbian player, a multiple time MVP in the Adriatic League. I saw some people talking about like because of his like 6'7", 240 or something like that. So they called him like the Serbian Barkley. Like, he was a great rebounder and like a tough as nails scorer inside. But you mentioned he had the relationship with Jokic, coached him at Mega. He kind of turned that team into an NBA pipeline, like a factory where you had guys like not just Jokic. It was Ivica Zubats and Vasa Micic and Goga Vitadze, like guys that came over from there, Timothy Luau Cabarro, Vlatko Chanchar, guys that were, I think it was 11 guys total drafted from the team during his time coaching them. And then a handful of those guys actually came over and made, have made an impact, you know, most notably, of course, Jokic, an assistant on the Serbian national team, like, but guys really, he made that impact on a lot of people. It was a really sweet thing, and we can move off of it. But like, Darko Rajakovic, head coach of the Raptors, you know, knew him from when they were kids. And he was very broken up about it, very emotional about it before and after the Raptors game on Wednesday night. But he ran the first play of the game that they ran in Toronto. Was he said it was an ATO that he took from his friend, and they got a three out of it. You know, Gary Trent Jr. got a wide open three out of it. And after the game, Coach Rajakovic had said, like, that's what he brought to Golden State. That's what he brought to the league. And, you know, to the extent that there are silver linings about these things, the impact that those sorts of coaches and those sorts of people have on the players that they touch, the coaches that they worked with along the way, that kind of stuff stays in the bloodstream. It stays in the ecosystem of the league. And, you know, maybe some coaches are going to be running that play for 50, 60 years. Who knows? Like, the impacts that we leave, you know, stick around long after we do.
The Indiana Pacers made the biggest splash so far of the trade deadline earlier on Wednesday, where they sent three first round picks, a pair of 2024 firsts, which we'll get into that, I think, a little bit later, a 2026 first round pick, which is the Pacers' own pick, protected 1 through 4, and Bruce Brown, Jordan Nwora out the door from Indiana, plus a surprise of Kyra Lewis from New Orleans being the last salary piece needed to match Pascal Siakam's $37.8 million on the books of his expiring contract. I think the first blush reaction for me in all this was that the Pacers really pushed their chips in the table and got their guy. This was a 2.5 year long odyssey for Indiana, looking at every power forward under the sun. And they were definitely involved. And it seemed like, even maybe from the outside perspective, liked OG Anunoby more than Pascal Siakam. But this price package seems pretty damn steep to me. Like, this, I mean, I've been talking about how the 2024 draft being considered not that rich of franchise changing talents has led me to suspect that we'll see a bunch of first round picks in this year's draft traded before February 8th, the trade deadline. Two of them have already been moved in this deal, being that one is the lesser of the picks between the Jazz, Clippers, Rockets, Thunder, which, I mean, the Clippers and the Thunder are tracking to be two of the top four teams in the West. So
yeah, that could be like 27 to 30 somewhere in that area. Right.
The Pacers are certainly hoping this pick helps them climb into that territory in the East. So in theory, these could already be two of the 10 picks between 20 and 30 of this draft out the door. So that's one trend piece to kind of touch on here and say to the listeners to look out for more of these types of picks being on the market and actually fungible draft capital that will be moved, that can be moved. But I do think one thing, just from following your tweets, Dan, it seemed like the three first round pick sticker shock was a lot for some people, which I know you and I were talking about it behind the scenes. So maybe you had a little bit of confidence in the 2024
maybe
package being part of it.
Maybe I knew a little something. I knew a guy who knew a guy.
Yeah. I agree with you in that those two picks really aren't like banner return. They're not the top three protected Lakers pick from 2020. You know what I'm saying?
Like, right, yeah.
They're not remotely going to be considered one of the top 10 draft picks that's out the door that someone holds right now. But two first round picks are two first round picks. And who's to say what this 2026 pick will ever be? Like, it's just, it is far out in the future. Pascal is going to be 32 at that point. You know, just there's never really anything to guarantee.
Sure.
So that plus Bruce Brown, who we'll talk about for sure, about his retrade value. I'm looking at that as kind of like an incomplete. I'm looking at this return as an incomplete, similar to what Portland got back for Damian Lillard, and then yes, a Drew Holiday type sweepstakes unfolded after my preamble. What was your initial reaction to this final or this temporarily final return?
Yeah. So from the Raptors standpoint, I think your point about the Blazers and the Dame return is a really good one. I think that's a good comparison, because you kind of have to bundle it all together from Toronto's perspective. It's not just what did you get back for Siakam. It's what did you get back for Siakam and OG Anunoby, and then whatever else you move before in the next 3 weeks before the trade deadline, as sort of this wholesale reimagination of what the roster can look like.
Don't say rebuild. How dare you say rebuild?
I know. I had to like hit the gap of the break. I was like revamping, retooling, re-envisioning of what the roster could look like.
The Wizards also say they're not rebuilding either. They're just like reshaping. You know,
are they even building? Is anything under construction? Are we aware of you know, shovel in ground? Sorry, that's unfairly diminishing to Bilal Coulibaly. I apologize.
Yeah. And they paired college best friends, Isaiah Livers and Jordan Poole, back together again.
Incredible. So, love conquers all, hope springs eternal. So from the Raptors perspective, yeah, you look at it and say they were able to turn these two sort of cornerstone pieces of previous regime into a couple of young players that they think can be part of their core moving forward in Emmanuel Quickley and RJ Barrett, then multiple draft picks in this, you know, this draft, and then in 2026, which is a top four projected. Like, the best case scenario for them is that things go haywire in Indiana and that turns into the fifth pick in the draft. And there's a chance that could happen for sure. Plus, you have the, as you said, Bruce Brown can be redirected. I would imagine that and we'll get into the Raptors a little bit more in a second, but so they are moving toward a full, like, kind of compensation package of what they can get from moving on. Maybe a little bit too late, but whatever. You know, the best time to stop making yesterday's mistakes is right now. So that's them moving forward from here. From the Pacers' perspective, yeah, I understood the initial shock that people had at the idea of, like, how the hell are you giving up three first round picks for a guy who can be a free agent in 4 months? Like, and I get that. Pascal Siakam's set to hit unrestricted free agency. He is a similar sort of bucket as somebody like Julius Randle, who we've talked about a lot on this show, where it's like all-star, yes, all-NBA, yes, but he's closer to like the edge of that conversation than the center of it, and has been for several years. And so it's like, that guy's really good, but is he worth all of that, especially as he's a flight risk? And so I think what we've seen from the immediate aftermath reporting, both in terms of the pick protections that you laid out, the timing of the picks that they will be past those encumbrances in 3 years, and that you have the initial word appears to be, whereas previously it was reported that Siakam wasn't very interested in re-signing anywhere, that he would get traded, he apparently likes the idea of being in Indiana with Tyrese Halliburton and with a team that has his bird rights, that doesn't really get free agents, and that might be willing to spend to keep him around. He likes that idea quite a bit. So if that is true, and if we get into the summertime and then there is whether it's a full max deal, a near max deal, whatever, for Pascal Siakam on the table from the Pacers, then you're talking about you gave up these things. The downside risk there is you're paying Pascal Siakam, you know, $50+ million in his age 34 and 35 seasons. And that could be really bad too. Like, absolutely. But to turn non-star players and non-premium picks into a second all-NBA talent in Indianapolis feels like alchemy to me. Like, not just like a gamble, but it feels like wizardry. And so we'll see I think the fit has a chance to be really, really clean and really, really good. I think he can elevate their offense in ways that maybe OG Anunoby couldn't, because of what he can do with the ball. He wouldn't be as an immediate a fix on the defensive end as Anunoby would, but just having somebody big to be on the wing bumps everybody else back into more natural matchups. I think this is a home run. It's a home run swing, and I think it's got a really good chance of connecting.
I like the deal for all three teams involved. I think the Pacers, to your point, they were never guaranteed to sign someone of his magnitude on the open market. They just weren't. Their last best free agent signing, to my knowledge, that was came from outside the building was David West. Way back
when. It's David West or like Bojan Bogdanovic, and like these are fine players, but yeah, this is a you're shopping in a different part of the store.
The Raptors, like we talked about, have an incomplete. They have more stuff to do. Kyra Lewis was a lottery pick for a reason. He has basically been buried in New Orleans because of everyone else in front of him. He had a torn ACL, I believe.
One of the bad A's that knocked him out
For a pretty critical season. He was like supposed to be their starting point guard after Lonzo left, basically, or he was going to have an opportunity for it. So theoretically untapped upside there. And the Pelicans got under the luxury tax and have extra roster spots to be able to play around with moving forward. So I think it's fine for all account. You're not getting back your Emmanuel Quickly, let alone an RJ Barrett that you got from the Knicks. But Bruce Brown does have, I think, incredible retrade value. We'll talk about finding him a new team in a second. But I just want to, like, the idea that Indy gave a balloon payment to Bruce Brown with a team option on the second year. You know, at first we started to hear, oh, like the Nuggets are going to be able to keep him. And then it was like, oh, like, will he go to the Lakers for the mid-level? And then it was, oh, no, Bruce Brown's got like $20 million from someone. And then we found out it was the Pacers. One of my first thoughts back then was Bruce Brown doesn't make the most sense next to a high usage, high pick and roll point guard like Tyrese Haliburton.
Right.
He was basically a Swiss Army knife, whatever you want to put him at any position, offensive player for Brooklyn and then Denver when he won the title. So the questions weren't like so glaring. But my immediate thought was, well, this guy on that deal will be a pretty interesting trade chip, like from the get-go. I mean, I think his representation knew that from the jump too. But when you can get $22 million for a player who really didn't have any business commanding that at that state, I mean, no one else came in close to that salary range. And then to just be able to flip him, a guy who was buried on your bench, two picks between 20 and 30, and who knows what the 2020, maybe the 2026 pick, as much as I said, it could be valuable for Toronto. Like maybe it's 29 again. You never know. Like to do all that for someone of Pascal's magnitude, who by all accounts, Tyrese Haliburton wants to play with. And by all accounts, Tyrese Haliburton is, or has been motivating people behind the scenes to really ramp this thing up and bring in talent. I know Mark Stein wrote that the Pacers were expected to be a team to go pursue Paul George this summer in free agency. Tyrese Haliburton's been on Paul George's podcast. They were intrigued, from my understanding, about the idea of playing together. So to bring in Pascal eliminates you from the theoretical ex all-star who could become available at any point in time that the Knicks are waiting for, that Miami's waiting for, that Philly's waiting for. Right. But like, you don't always get that guy. So to actually point and get someone in there, I like it. And I think to keep this like looking forward, there's going to be more to come from the Raptors no matter what. I think Indy has a potential consolidation trade still to make because they already have had a logjam in the front court where
right.
Obi and Jalen Smith and Isaiah Jackson were all kind of burying Jairus Walker. And now you just added an all-star power forward on top of all that. So we'll see if there's any more tinkering to come from Indiana. I think the more likely outcome of either of these teams continuing to shuffle the deck is Toronto, where Dennis Schroeder, I don't think is on that list though. I think he is someone that could generate outcoming or incoming interest and probably will, but I think he's someone that has a good standing with that organization and being that culture setter that Darko Rajakovic kind of wanted to have in this reshaping of what the Raptors culture was going to be in this new, I mean, Toronto wasn't prepared going into this year to make all these trades necessarily. They were prepared. It was a possibility. And to bring in a new coach with a new voice and a new vision. Like, this is his veteran that's doing that and was not the most thrilled to move to the bench, but like is doing it as a good soldier. And I just don't expect him to be someone out the door. Chris Boucher, Gary Trent Jr. I mean, I don't know what trade value Otto Porter or Thad Young have. I see Jontay Porter on our list. Like, he's not good.
Yeah,
he's not going anywhere.
For the purposes of discussion, I'm saying, like, we were looking at, like, in the rundown, just like who's left, who's on the team, and then those guys are also there on the team. I don't know what, like, my guess would be, you're probably right. Like, there's not great value to be had in Otto Porter or maybe Boucher. I don't know. But yeah, Thad Young, probably not a whole lot of value out there to be had. It's more that, yeah, Jontay Porter is like, that's a reclamation project that he's already providing plus value for you on, you know, for hardly any money. There's no reason for you to move off of him. But just generally speaking, like, the Raptors feel closer now to see what you can get for whatever's not nailed down that isn't Scotty Barnes and Emmanuel Quickly. And then you sort of figure things out from there.
Yeah, so I think it's Gary Trent, Chris Boucher, and that's kind of really the only names I'm looking at outside of the big ticket item of Bruce Brown, mm-hmm. who...
So let me ask you that by way of setup. Like, so my first thought after this all happens is, yeah, as you mentioned, they have Bruce Brown is in the first year of that huge balloon payment deal. The second year of it is a team option for, I believe, $23 million or $24 million. So he becomes either an expiring contract or a player that a team could say, like, well, we want to add him to our mix for next year. And having just seen him be an important piece for a playoff team, it made me wonder, like, was there immediate rumblings about, like, could he have value to a playoff team on the market?
Oh, absolutely. Especially a market that, as I've been saying, I don't think has a ton of top six rotation guys available right now.
Right.
He's 27 years old. He can fit various timelines. He can be the veteran piece that the Pacers wanted to target. He could be the missing piece in a lot of situations. I mean, off top of dome, teams that are looking for two-way talents at the guard position, I mean, he is represented by CAA. Could be an interesting piece for the New York Knicks, which has designs on other moves. Like, we were talking about DeJounte Murray last week about, you know, does he go to, if he went, if in the theoretical situation he goes to Miami, would that rule out the Heat for Donovan Mitchell? Like, Bruce Brown with that team option could be just like that for New York, as someone who they could flip again in theory. Philly, he could be an interesting pairing next to Tyrese Maxey in the backcourt. I don't necessarily think the Sixers are like looking for a true point guard who's going to move Tyrese off the ball full time. I think there's opportunities and interest to like shift him off ball occasionally and try to maximize him coming off pin downs and whatnot. But I don't know if Bruce is necessarily like the guy who can run the second unit or run the offense when Tyrese is on the bench type thing. So that's not as clean a fit to me as Bruce Brown does feel so Knicks-y. Like, put him in that Dante DiVincenzo, Josh Hart reserve lineup, and I wonder how like many switching steals, transition opportunities these guys are going to get together.
Make the whole second unit out of 6'4" guys who kind of can dribble a little bit and can kind of shoot a little bit and who just play super hard all the time. Yeah, I mean, there's something to it. The Knicks thing is interesting to me. Because I'm a glutton for punishment Knicks fan, but like the question of what are they going to, like, the Knicks have that sort of like exploding asset of Evan Fournier's contract. And like every year we get like one or two stories that's just like, yeah, I'd like to play, but it's just, it's not going to happen. Doesn't seem like it's likely to happen for me. So maybe I can go someplace and play. Maybe not. Nope. They're keeping me around just in case they need to match me in a salary for a deal. And like, so if you are the Knicks and you could theoretically attach a pick or some kind of draft compensation to Fournier's deal to the Raptors to get, we've already got the great working relationship with Toronto, despite the lawsuit, the another deal just happened. You sort of like preserve the salary slot, actually increase the salary slot a little bit because the next year of Brown's deal is bigger than the Fournier deal. And maybe improve your rotation depth today with a guy you would play, and then still have the opportunity to guarantee that deal for next year, use it as matching salary. I think I can understand the incentive structure for the Knicks to do that. I don't know that it would be worth if they'd be willing to give up something worth the Raptors' while for that. I wonder about that, but I kind of get that. It makes sense to me. For me, just like a history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. I kind of love the idea of the Sixers getting involved, because now we see what he looks like playing off the other MVP center guy. You know, like he was the backup point guard in Denver last year, but like work. And so, yeah, he can't run the whole second unit on his own. But like, if he works off of Embiid being the guy who you run everything through, and he's just bringing the ball up the court and entering the ball, maybe there's something there. And it's like a middle ground between find your all-star guy, third partner for Embiid and Maxey, and Stan Pat. And then again, provides Daryl Morey theoretically with the flexibility to either let that money come off the books this summer or package him up for something further. I was trying to sort of think through who else could make some sense with it. And like, I mean, I'm sure that Denver would love to have him back, but I don't think they have the matching money to do it. The Suns, I know you had reported they were kind of figuring out what kind of conversations they could get into with like a Grayson Allen, Nasir Little package. But like, I think you'd have to add too much money to them to get to Brown's number, that it probably isn't worth Phoenix's while.
Yeah, they're together at $16 million.
Yeah, so you'd have to add, I think, probably what, like a Kogi or Kata Bates Diop or Eric Gordon or something like that, just to get closer. And at that point, you know, is it worth your while in terms of what you're adding to your rotation? I don't know. Yeah, I, as I was going through the list of teams, I feel like I was coming up short. Is there anybody that I haven't mentioned that you sort of, have you either been hearing things about or that you think lines up maybe?
To be clear, I have not heard that the Miami Heat are pursuing Bruce Brown, but that'd be an interesting fit to me. And it could potentially allow a trade where Kyle Lowry gets moved back to Toronto. So that was just one other thought that I had in mind. But yeah, I think that's part of why, to wrap all this up, I think that is part of why this deal happened now. I think that's part of why Toronto has been the one team that's making deals left and right. Made two deals. Just because...
Well, one left, one right. You know, yeah.
One left, one right. So, yeah, I mean, there was like a rumor going around the NBA on Monday that the Raptors had told teams, you got 48 hours. I have no idea if that's real. But, you know, pretty much typically, almost exactly 48 hours later, Pascal Siakam gets moved. The Raptors have another piece to potentially dangle, and we will see how all the dominoes continue to unfold as we have three full weeks.
Time is folding in on itself. Yeah.
I'm losing my mind every Monday. I wake up, I'm like, oh, the deadline's Thursday. And that's just me wanting to go to sleep on February 9th. So to take a step away from all the trade rumors and gossip and mud, let's do some midseason awards. We're going to move through them pretty quickly. I'll just go each guy and have a little banter and keep it going quickly. So
Before we get started, I just want to say, so the impetus for this is I'm writing a midseason awards column for Friday Yahoo Sports. And I am trying to underthink this one. I'm making a concerted effort to chill out a little bit, partially because like the year end one where I actually have a real ballot and it impacts like guys' money and their legacies and stuff like that. That one I want to take as seriously as I can, because that matters for a lot of reasons. This doesn't matter for jack shit. This is just like it's something to go up on the website on a Friday and something for us to talk about on a podcast. So I'm gonna, like, if you disagree with my picks here, that is completely fine. I do not care. And we'll do the best that we can to have a lot of fun with it.
I'm also saying, yeah, I'm using this as a little bit of an exercise to give a couple people some shout outs and some love that I think are deserving of it. So, Coach of the Year, last year's winner, Mike Brown, took the award for a second time. Dan, who do you have as your Coach of the Year so far through about 35-ish games?
I think this award is going to go to Mark Daigneault of the Oklahoma City Thunder. I'm going with Eric Spoelstra of the Miami Heat, because the fact that Eric Spoelstra, and the midseason hypothetical award does not exist, but Eric Spoelstra not having a Coach of the Year award feels like a cosmic injustice. in the annals of NBA history.
Don't worry, they made up for it with a record-setting contract for the guy.
That's true. Yeah, he's going to, you know, be crying himself to sleep on bags with giant dollar signs on them. But so the Heat, and we talked about this a little bit with Rohan Nadkarni on Divine Intervention recently, but like the Heat have had, and Jake, by the way, we are definitely getting you on Divine Intervention soon. Just like, just hang in there. Wait for the invite. It's coming.
I'm ready. My phone is literally right here.
Phone is off. It's in the other room, but I just hang in there.
Is it often in the other room?
It is actually often in the other room. Professional broadcaster.
Well, I did that at the gym the other day. It was like the most amazing hour of my life.
Well, yeah, we operate on different phone tethering needs. No one is telling me information. No one is asking me what I think about information. I'm not communicating in that way. So it's a little bit easier for me to have the phone aside. Also, the Heat have had Jimmy Butler, Bam Adebayo, and Tyler Hero on the court for 10 games this season, less than 200 minutes. The only rotation guys they've had injuries all throughout the roster. The only rotation guys who haven't missed like 5+ games or more than that is Duncan Robinson and Jaime Jaquez. They have the 20th ranked offense in the league. They have their point differential is less than a point a game over the course of the first 41 games. It's like plus 27 in 41 games, and they're 24-17 and a game out of fourth in the East. So like, it's not, you know, there are a million great choices. Eric Spoelstra, everybody knows, is the best or in the top three coaches in the league conversation. So what the hell? Why not give him a recognition for doing the wizard shit again to get that Heat team to where they are going to be a very dangerous team if and when they actually get everybody healthy.
I know, so we're trying to make this quick, but
sorry,
my thing will be quick. No. I saw that the thing I said about Duncan Robinson with my friends on Locked On Heat, that he is untouchable, got taken and blasted across the internet. I said that so tongue in cheek. to be clear.
You do this to yourself.
Untouchable these days.
You're going on all these spaces. You're going on all these podcasts.
I'm trying to sell one last round of books to get the escrow check that it's been sitting frozen for like 2 years now. To really pull the curtain back. The board needs that money. But
Built to Lose in bookstores now. Go buy it.
It's right here. It's right there. It's blocked by some light that isn't helping the positioning to be in the background of all my podcasting. But that's neither here nor there. Yeah, Duncan's is playing well. The Heat don't want to move him. I'm sure he's available in the right context, but he's not someone they're actively trying to move compared to other years. So there you go. My choice, like you said, Mark Dangenal. I do think what he's doing with the Oklahoma City Thunder has been remarkable for several years now. The proof is now in the pudding. Number 2C, number 3C, whatever they are as of recording in the West. And they're going to continue to be a plucky upstart contender, I think, throughout this regular season. We'll see how it goes in the postseason. And the man deserves the attention and the love, being that there are plenty of people in the NBA who still can't pronounce his name. So shout out to Mark Dangenal for coaching circles around a lot of those people. Executive of the year, last year's winner, Monty McNair. That was me getting ready to say Monty. I think Monty got that largely for the Domantas Sabonis trade he did the year before. I'm thinking of this award for someone who did something during the year. The calendar year starts on June 30th at 6 p.m. So in theory, stuff done in the offseason and in the months leading up. You know, if you wanted to shout out John Horst and the Bucks for Dame Lillard, go for it. But to me, I'm looking at the biggest piece being moved in what I think is a very fair cost after taking that Bruce Brown contract at the Pascal Siakam. I'm giving a shout out to Kevin Pritchard and the Indiana Pacers front office, who A, made my job easier, and us for having something to talk about substantively 3 weeks before February 8th. And also, I do think it's a super strong decision-making tree that has shaped what this group is becoming in the East. And why not give it back-to-back to both sides of the equation of the Domas Tyrese trade that will live forever as this great win-win for both sides?
I think that's fantastic. You know, my pick was, we'll stay in the East with it, and it's more like the sort of straightforward, these are the two moves you have made before in this sort of season cycle that led you to where you need to be. Brad Stevens with the Celtics, you know, coming off that loss to the Heat in the Eastern Conference Finals, they knew they needed to reorient the team in some way. Marcus Smart goes out, Kristaps Porzingis comes in, a deal that a lot of people, myself included, were very skittish about, very like nervy about what that does to your culture, what that does to your organization. Then they are able to follow it up when the Damian Lillard deal happens by swooping in and getting Jrue Holiday from the Portland Trail Blazers. And that immediately answered virtually every question we had about Marcus Smart going out the door. And the result has been the best starting lineup or best top six in the league, one of the best starting lineups in the league, and a team that's been an absolute wrecking crew, 32-9, number one in net rating by all, you know, pretty much every metric you can look at, the best team in the NBA so far. And that has been set, was set up by the moves that Brad Stevens made this summer. And in addition to like bringing back Jaylen Brown, right? Like re-signing Jaylen Brown, as a lot of people sort of swallowed hard at that deal, but it kept the structure in place that they could then add to put together what looks like the best Celtics team of this era. So it brings me no great pleasure to be another guy on a podcast talking about the Celtics, but Brad Stevens has put himself in position to earn that kind of recognition.
Another white guy on a podcast talking about the Celtics.
Yeah, I mean, yes, correct.
Yeah, no, the Jrue trade was phenomenal. And there was a point where I was definitely saying and telling people that Jrue's trade value, I thought, exceeded what Pascal's was. And the fact that Pascal ended up going for three picks, I think, was surprising to a lot of people in the league, because like even I texted someone with Sacramento when the first like three picks stuff came out. And they're like, oh, three picks, like good grief, like good for Indiana, you know? So and only that's another lesson that it only takes one asshole, but the Celtics were not one. They were one of many, and they got Jrue, and it's been pretty perfect ever since. Clutch player of the year, last year's winner, De'Aaron Fox. A lot of kings last year. Dan, who's your king of the clutch gene this season?
So this is, we're talking about shout outs. I'm going to use this as an opportunity to shout out Mike Bowie, a great analytics dude who runs the site Inpredictable, has what he calls the Jerry West Clutch Player of the Year tracker, an analytic model that goes past just sort of like the clutch stuff on NBA.com, calculates how much a player adds to his team, to his team's win probability in clutch situations. And while you would think maybe Dame Lillard, because Dame Lillard is like leads the league in plus minus in the clutch, Giannis Antetokounmpo actually nudges ahead in the win probability added because of his play on the defensive end, the defensive rebounding, the blocked shots, the steals that he's gotten, in addition to his high scoring on great efficiency, generating free throws, all that kind of stuff. So since this doesn't matter, Giannis Antetokounmpo, you are number one in Mike Bowie's rankings, and that means you're number one for me.
Where does Anthony Simons rank in those rankings?
You know what? You vamp on Ant, and I'll go take a look.
Because, yeah, in the spirit of giving someone a shout-out, Ant Simons is balling out for the Portland Trail Blazers. This dude is hitting game winner after game winner. He is knocking down bucket after bucket at all 17,000 levels of the court. He seems to have any shot in his bag. As of December 22nd, our buddy Tom Haberstroh had Anthony Simons with the most points, most clutch points per 48 minutes. He only had 17 minutes, only had 17 clutch minutes, but he was outscoring Trae Young, Joel Embiid, and Steph Curry. So whatever the updated numbers are, Dan, you don't have to find them if you don't have them at this point.
Well,
after I've been vamping.
Would it bum you out to know that he's not in the top 50 of Mike Bowie's Clutch Player of the Year tracker?
Well, because that is, as it relates to Whitta Gabes and the Portland Trail Blazers, have not won many a clutch game. Right. The one they have, the Anthony Simons,
The probability that they're in a close game is vanishingly small. So that's why he doesn't wind up there. But when they get in there, man, he's hell on wheels.
When they get in there, he is dangerous. So shout out to Ant Simons. He really has been awesome. So just someone I wanted to give a little bit of love to here. The Hustle Award, I couldn't come up with anybody besides Dan Devine, who just hustling it up for Ball Don't Lie twice a week podcast, writing words, tweeting conscious streams of thought at all times. Dan Devine, take a bow.
No, I won't. Preposterous. This is you shirking your responsibilities to our audience and cheating the readers, and I can't abide by it. I will give an answer that is an actual answer, and that answer's name is Alex Caruso, the headband wizard. He is sort of like a spiritual partner of Marcus Smart as the kind of chaos agent that I think this is intended to recognize. always the concern of like, he doesn't play enough minutes because he plays so hard in the minutes he does that they're worried he's going to kill himself if they extend him for like longer minutes. But average is just under 2 steals and 5 deflections per 36. He's 10th in charges drawn. When you look at like steals plus blocks per minute, which is something that team rankings, this website team rankings checks stocks per minute, everybody above him is either like a shot blocking big man or Matisse Thybulle, who like, again, has that one job of just being a crazy chaos agent. And Caruso does that while also being like a much more positive player all over the court. So I think he is the kind of guy that if he, we talked about him before, if he became available on the market, or if a team was willing to meet the Bulls price for it, like he could be a full on defensive game changer for just about any team in the league. And he's one of the reasons that the Bulls maddeningly, stubbornly kind of keep staying in the competitive rankings of like the play in berth. It's a TM play in push because Caruso just kind of makes stuff happen constantly when he's on the court. So he feels like the right kind of player to acknowledge there. But also, if you're not sure who you would want to pick, I can just name some guys if you wanted to
get. I have.
You have one? All right, go for somebody. It.
But why are you mad about the Bulls being in the playoff, the play in push, the TM play in push?
They. You know, it's a fair point. I'm not mad. I'm a little disappointed that it's not, it just kind of feels like the same note over and over again. Like you say, it's like the white noise machine that puts you to sleep at night. Like, it's just like, with the exception of, you know, there are exceptions there, you know, DeMar DeRozan in the clutch is wonderful. Kobe White has been sensational, but like by and large, you kind of watch them and you're like, and I wind up.
I'm watching them, waiting to see something from Patrick Williams that the Bulls front office has seen for the last 4 years. That's what I watch the Chicago Bulls for.
Yeah.
My quick answer, just I wrote about him. He is arguably the most important piece of the Boston Celtics that Brad Stevens has built. Derek White, number one in the league in net rating, number one in your hearts. He's just always tipping balls and diving on the floor and getting rebounds. That Jason Tatum game winner against the Timberwolves comes to mind from, I think it was last Saturday, or no, that was Wednesday before the TNT doubleheader where Boston got blown to pieces by Milwaukee. Right.
Second end of a back-to-back.
Game winner came after a Derek White offensive rebound. Shout out Derek White, who I had a lovely chat with over Zoom on last Sunday while he wore a giant puffy black winter coat indoors. And I was wondering how warm he was, but maybe it was just cold up there in New England. So shout out Derek White. Really nice guy. Really great hustler. And someone who I think is going to continue to get paid a lot of money in this league for all that stuff. Someone who's going to make a bunch of cash in this league is our mutual rookie of the year choice in Chet Holmgren, who I'm going to say I'm very concerned, I guess is the word, that the league is going to force feed a Victor Chet Co. rookie of the year outcome, just because they've done it in the past with Jason Kidd and Grant Hill, to my recollection. And there was another one in the 90s of two. I think it was maybe Chris Webber and someone else. But
I actually,
it's like
remember.
An award that people don't really care about too much. This is an award that Tyreek Evans got with the Sacramento Kings. And it's made some great fodder. We've talked about it with the Donovan Mitchell rookie definition sweatshirt stuff. And who can forget the big battle between the Michael Carter Williams camp and the Victor Oladipo camp of 2014?
I can forget I very much forgot that.
I remember
that.
Zach Lowe made an impassioned plea for Victor Oladipo and everyone at Liberty Ballers. And everyone in the Philly sports media wanted to take pitchforks to Zach Lowe because how could you ignore the counting stats of Michael Carter Williams? I think Chet deserves the recognition for doing what he's doing on a winning team. That's not to say what Victor is doing is less impressive because the pieces around him are not Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and what have you. But I just think it is remarkable that Chet has just been dropped into a burgeoning contender in the West and has been not only just their second best player, but a legitimate all-star candidate in this year who's putting up numbers in line with Hall of Fame enshrinement if he can keep it up for the next decade plus. So that's my Chet Holmgren rant.
Yeah, it's a good one. I firmly agree with it. Two things. I want to say super producer John Gennaro didn't get on mic for this one, but he did drop it in the chat. There was Elton Brand and Steve Francis shared the award in the 99-2000 season. And as you had mentioned, yeah, 94-95, Grant Hill, Jason Kidd. So there is a precedent for a split award there. I think, yeah, this is something where we need to, like, I was listening to some, now I don't remember, so forgive me, but I was listening to somebody where the discussion was, well, yeah, but what if you put Victor in Oklahoma City? And it's like, yeah, okay, but, you know, that's not what is reality. So, like, yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean that one thing is more impressive or less impressive than the other. Victor Wembanyama, you got me saying Oladipo because we're talking about Zach Lowe's impassioned pleas of the past. Victor Wembanyama has been, you know, ludicrous. And I think this absolutely could just wind up being him winning, going away, even with how great Chet has been by season's end.
For sure.
Like, the trend line is leaping, like, all, like, off the page for Victor since they started. They moved him to center on December 8th, rather. And since that time, it's 21 points, 11 rebounds, just under 4 blocks, and 3.5 assists per game. They're already a league average defense with him playing at center. Like, they've been terrible all year. You put him on the court with Trey Jones, as we've talked about before, they're about plus 6 points per 100. Like, if this sort of continues the trend that it's been going the last 15, 20 games, whatever it has, with him at center and the way that they play, the numbers might just be, like, beyond reproach to a degree that he winds up winning, even though the Thunder are the superior team and Chet has been playing a gigantic role on a really good team all year. But I think that that's, like, I don't think you can understate the value of that. Yes, doing what Victor Wembanyama is doing without the surrounding talent is really hard, but so is needing to play 30 minutes a night on a team that thinks it can win a championship and, like, actually elevating that team to that level, not making mistakes, not being somebody that has to get yanked off the floor because you can't hold up on defense or you're going to get bodied too often. You're not going to make the shots that are created for you. You're not going to generate shots for others. Chet Holmgren's been doing all of that and then some. And so, yeah, I mean, in terms of just the entirety of what he's produced in the first half, I think it would be Chet. But if you wanted to say Victor Wembanyama, I'm not going to throw a fit about it. I think that's, like, the fact that there's such a good argument for both guys is a pretty impressive thing, given how much was expected of both of them coming in, that they've been able to not only meet but exceed those expectations is kind of crazy.
Our next award, I'm actually mad at what Dan put on the rundown.
Okay.
This is a strong take of mine. Most improved player should not go to someone who was already an all-star.
Okay.
The year Ja Morant won most improved player was absolutely absurd. And the fact that he gave it to Desmond Bane was a very charming and endearing moment to me, because Desmond Bane actually, like, improved from no one with any real expectations to, like, max player that season, versus Ja went from all-star to all-NBA player. So the fact you put Tyrese Haliburton on this document pisses me off, because Tyrese Maxey has become an all-star this year. In a season where I remember talking to Tyrese preseason, they were at Baruch College at morning shoot-around, and he was dealing with whether James Harden was going to be there or not. And all the guy did to respond was come out and take James Harden's step back three and push his way into this real upper echelon of the league, to the point where he's a legitimate number two second banana to Joel Embiid in this title race. So it should be Tyrese Maxey over Tyrese Haliburton. How dare you? And I'm as big a Tyrese Haliburton fan as there is, but you got the wrong Tyrese, buddy.
That's totally fine. I have been a voter in the past who has looked at it and said, the hardest thing to do, the hardest leap to make, is to become, like, the best in the world. And there are not many spots available for that. I voted for Luka Doncic in 2020. I voted for Ja in 2022. I don't think there was a similar candidate in 2021. I voted for Randall, going from, like, pretty good to all NBA. And
you said there aren't a lot of spots for those guys. There are plenty of spots for those guys to get honored with all-star and all NBA voting, where there are also guys who maybe deserve a little bit of shine, who can get a little most improved trophy I don't know.
Yeah. It's a defensible position. It's just not one that I agree with. I think that the hardest thing to do is become, like, a top five, top six, top seven player in the world. And Tyrese Haliburton has done that. If we're talking about, like, it's not just that he's getting more minutes, right? He has legitimately leveled up across the board, even from his all-star berth last year. nearly 4 more points and 4 more assists per 100 possessions than last year. 2-point accuracy and 3-point accuracy both up despite the higher volume. Turnover rate down despite the playmaking responsibility increasing. Like, he has gotten better. It has improved to the point where he has gone from all-star, like nice story add-on all-star, to driver of one of the best offenses we have ever seen. By estimated plus minus, the best offensive player in the NBA this season, and a legitimate, like, he's probably going to wind up on the outside of the MVP ballot, but not on all of them. And especially if they make another run in the second half here with Siakam on board, like, he could absolutely wind up in the top five in MVP voting. And that is, like, that's rarefied air, man. That's just, it is the hardest thing in the league to do is to get there. And he's getting there. So I get it. I hear your point. Maxey would, I would not, like, in the same way that I voted for SGA last year and Lauri Markkanen won, and that is completely reasonable. That's super defensible. I would expect something similar to happen this year. I think Tyrese Maxey would be a phenomenal pick and probably would wind up getting more votes than Haliburton for the same reason that you're offering here. And there's other guys in that same kind of camp, like Alperen Şengün or Scottie Barnes, who are going from, like, have earned, but now, like, leveled up to all-star status. Like, that's totally fine. It's just not the way that I went from it. But the thing that I struggle with more than the kind of conversation that we're having is how you gauge improvement on, like, a lower wattage of player and, like, how you reward that. And to that end, just real quick, one time for Dante Exum, all right, in Dallas.
One time.
He went from, I can't stay healthy and I can't contribute enough offensively to stay on the court in Utah, and then, like, bounced around.
Comeback player of the year, Dante Exum.
If they had that award, for sure. Yeah. I mean, like, he winds up out of the league. He goes to Europe and plays in Spain and then I think in Serbia for a couple of years, and, like, irons out his shot and figures out how to make himself a more viable player, and then comes back. And now he's, like, a 45% 3-point shooter who's playing real rotation minutes in Dallas and, like, has a role in the league. So that kind of improvement, it took a circuitous route for him to get there, but that's real improvement from a guy who's not in that same, like, all-star, all-NBA kind of conversation that gets you, like, in the league and sticks around. And that is worth recognizing as well. So whether we do it on a ballot or in writing or whatever, we're doing it here. One time for Dante Exum.
Another awards take, which I have plenty of takes about the awards, apparently. I do think Sixth Man of the Year can be a co-award. I thought it was very cute and sweet when Montrezl Harrell and Lou Williams came together and were, you know, they were the bench mob. Mo Wagner and Cole Anthony, shout out my magic, where these guys I like for different reasons. Cole Anthony, I thought, was truly, like, a garbage player in past years, just like a buckets getter, no real calories guy, and he has absolutely changed that without any hesitancy in my mind, being a true impact player on both sides of the floor. He's rebounding like hell out of that position, just uncorks a vicious dunk every night. And Mo Wagner is truly one of the most efficient scoring big men in the league. I think there might only be one better foul grifter big scoring big man out there, and his name is Joel Embiid. And he just is so good at dominating second units that they wanted to put Goga Batadze in the starting lineup, and Wendell Carter went down. And Goga then became a real starting level player, to the point now people are considering Wendell Carter Jr. available for trade. So shout out Mo Wagner for being so good. He is changing the course of history in the Orlando Magic. Give me the Wagner, Cole Anthony, Sixth Man of the Year honors right now.
Yeah, tired Mo Wagner, wired Wagner. He is, you know,
there you go.
You know, Wagner, Cole Anthony, Cole Wagner. Anyway, I'm losing my mind. We were all up early today. Mine, I'm going to go with Malik Monk. I'm going to be honest, I wasn't totally sure where to go on this. Like, there's a lot of really good choices and a lot of guys who sort of operate in different important ways for their teams as their top reserve. Malik Monk is kind of a classic sort of selection, instant offense guy off the bench who can kind of help unlock your team's best self and, like, injection of excitement and great vibes. The statistical argument is there, you know, among guys who, like, primary bench guys. So spent, you know, more than half of the first half, like 20 plus games, not starting 15 plus minutes a game off the bench. He's sixth in points per game, second in assists per game, shooting just under 40% from three on super high volume. He's taken as many threes per 100 possessions as Duncan Robinson, the untouchable Duncan Robinson. he's got the best on-court, off-court splits of any Kings player that hasn't been a starter. And the Kings have a positive point differential when Monk plays without De'Aaron Fox and when he plays without Domantas Sabonis. So he's not like he's keeping those units afloat even when one or the other of the All-Stars is not on the court, which is a pretty important thing for a reserve to be able to do. Best assist rate of his career, best assist to turnover ratio of his career. And this number I like, this is like a fun, it brings the discussion full circle here. He's averaging more than 15 points and five assists per game, 26 minutes off the bench. The only guy in StatHead's database to average 15 and five in this few minutes while not starting. Lou Williams for the Los Angeles Clippers back in 2018-19 when he won the third of his three Sixth Man of the Year votes. So there's a symmetry to it. There's shouts to Lou Will for sure. And there's a certain symmetry to it. So there's plenty other, you know, we can remember some guys and shout out some other great picks, but I went with Malik Monk there. If you were to argue for the co-guys in Orlando, that's fine. Tim Hardaway Jr. has been sensational. Naz Reid, Norm Powell with the Clippers, Bogdan Bogdanovic with the Hawks, even though they've been bad, he's been great. Plenty of other choices there, but I think Malik Monk's a fun one.
Lou Williams once told me that he told a rookie Andre Iguodala, you can't party like AI and I, so you just gotta like take care of your body. There's few of us who are built this way and you can't do it.
You had that same conversation with me when we started the show. You were like, Dan, you know, my swag's too tough. I'm too different. You can't do it.
There's a difference between swag and the ability to just, yeah, never mind.
Ingest
and wake up the next day and still perform. Defensive player of the year last year, Jaren Jackson Jr. I'm just taking this opportunity to shout out Dylan Brooks and the Houston Rockets. I don't think Dylan Brooks is going to win Rookie of the Year, but defensive player of the year.
He's definitely not going to win
Rookie of the Year. Although he's having a great rookie year in Houston, great first year in Houston. The Rockets have started to take a bit of a tumble down the Western Conference standings, but they're still eighth in the league as of today. I just looked in defensive rating, and they were in town last night to play the Knicks. And like everyone I talked to from the Rockets has all just marveled at how well this team is playing on the defensive side of things, starting Jalen Green and Alperen Sengun. And Sengun has been like revelation, as you mentioned, on defense to me as much as it has been on offense. And we talked at Trade Around. I'll have more about that coming on the website after the trade deadline. Yeah, he was great. Like truly a lovely dude that I look forward to how much better his English will come over the coming years, because he's got such a great personality and he likes to talk and he's funny. And the more he gets comfortable, and that was a big part of our conversation too. Like the more he gets comfortable in this culture, let alone with this language, he's going to continue to shine. So shout out Alpi, shout out Dylan Brooks, and shout out for the Houston Rockets. Really impressive defense, being that was their goal, right? That was the whole talk of all the offs. They wanted to go chase these veterans to really establish a true defensive identity and culture under Ime Udoka, and they have done that.
The individual pick is a stretch, but it is a good way to shout out a very good defense.
It's a massive stretch.
If we're going to ruthlessly plug you, go back in the archives a little bit. I wrote a huge ass thing about the Rockets defense, like maybe a month ago or so. And you're absolutely right. Dylan Brooks and Fred VanVleet being like point of attack captains there has been a gigantic improvement for them. Mine is a boring pick, but it's the right one. It's Rudy Gobert.
He will win defensive player of the year. That is like the most locked, ironclad one of all of these.
Yeah, barring something dramatic changing in the next few months. I mean, best player on the best defense in the NBA. I like to check out a site called dunksandthrees.com, which factors in like strength of schedule, the opponents that you faced for your offensive and defensive ratings.
How many stat websites are you just going on every day?
When I'm working on this stuff, I like cross-referencing information. I like to get a lot of information in here. So this is one of the sources.
A lot of tabs,
really like a backbreaking amount of tabs. The Wolves have been nearly 2 points per 100 possessions better on defense than even second place Boston. Like there's a gap, and they've been their best self with Rudy Gobert on the floor. He's like blotting out the sun, man. Like he's seventh in the NBA in blocks, but that doesn't even account for it. Like watch a Wolves game for 5 minutes and you will see this the number of drivers who take down, like, don't even bother. They pull down the shots, they drive, they sort of get a toe into the paint, but then get out and kick it out or try to find something else because they do not want to put it up near him. He's going to swat it or you're going to contest it. Opponents take way fewer shots at the rim against when he's on the court. They take way fewer shots from three because the Wolves perimeter defenders get to stay closer on their guys because they know they've got help behind them. They shoot way worse whenever he's on the court. I mean, just like on and on and on. And even like the isolation defense, we've got there's that sort of trope that's been there for years and years. Like, well, you go small against him, you drag him out of the paint, you play him off the floor. Well, opponents are shooting 38% against him in isolation. He's given up like 0.75 points per possession in isolation. Like, you bring him out in space, you still got to deal with him and the 8-foot wingspan and everything else. So he has been like, it took a year. And it took him getting, you know, there were all the discussions about him being like, you know, nicks and bruises and dings and whatever last season. It took him some time to get acclimated, but he has been exactly what they hoped they were getting in Minnesota with that huge trade last offseason. And the results have been they've been the number one seed in the West for almost the entire first half. So I think you're absolutely right. He's a runaway favorite for it now. And if this pick stays the way it has been, he's probably on his way to his fourth Defensive Player of the Year trophy, which it's a little bit crazy sometimes to think like, well, Rudy Gobert is going to be in the Hall of Fame, but Rudy Gobert is probably going to be in the Hall of Fame if he's got four Defensive Player of the Year trophies and, you know, maybe even and counting.
He's definitely, without a doubt, one of the best defensive players to have ever graced the NBA. Who is your MVP, Dan Devine? And then let's get out of here.
Yeah. So we're going to wind up doing the same stuff that we've done the last 3 years, where it's kind of comes down probably to Nikola Jokic and Joel Embiid. And I was like this close, like put in the art request with our editors close to Nikola Jokic as the pick. And then I decided to say, fuck it, because this kind of doesn't really matter. I'm going with Joel Embiid. If you looked at the overall accumulation of numbers, Jokic has played 12 more games and like 400 more minutes. And then when the per minute value is so close, then the additional minute load matters a great deal. But again, that is a like year end award argument to me. Who do I think has been the best player in the league when he has been on the court this season? I think that's been Joel Embiid. And I think that it's all of it together. He got to the level last season where he actually got to the top of the mountain, and he has been better than that this season. Scoring efficiency has stayed the same, even on an even higher usage. I don't even know how Joel Embiid's usage could get higher, and yet here we are.
Well, they traded James Harden away.
Yeah, but then they gave up, as you mentioned, the most improved player in the league stepped into that void, sir. The leveled up passing, you got right around 6 assists a game, and they're running more through him, more handoffs in Nick Nurse offense, more operations where he's having to make those decisions from the post or from the high, you know, the slot there. He's returning the favor for Maxey that Harden did for him. Like, I'm going to help you elevate and level up. And everything has just continued to work sort of like without any sort of interruption, despite the trade of, and you know, your number one point guard and all NBA caliber player in Harden in his own right. He's also been like more often elite defensive Joel, which we know he can crank it up to that level, but he hasn't always sort of done that regularly through the regular season. They defend like the number two defense in the league with him on the court. Like he is a legitimate, will wind up on some ballots, Defensive Player of the Year candidate too this season. He's just better everywhere. And he was the MVP of the league last season. So, and also like not for nothing, it maybe didn't hurt to watch him take it to Jokic and the Nuggets the other night. Like that maybe, again, in a sandbox of none of this matters.
And obliterate Minnesota and Rudy Gobert.
Like these things don't hurt, right? I just think minute for minute, pound for pound, he's been the best dude in the league this season. Even if like the overarching stat argument might point toward Jokic in some areas, you know, we can deal with that in a few months and I'll tear my hair out about it. But for now, I'm just going to go with the guy that I think has been the best.
So Joel Embiid might not be eligible for MVP.
There's also that. Might as well give it to him now.
Yeah. If it doesn't reach the 65 game threshold. So in that event, if it's not, I mean, we just mentioned the game against Jokic, the Minnesota stuff. A 30-10 streak. The dude in the league who has had the most holy shit moments and holy shit games and holy shit, this guy is a cyborg here to come rip out your heart and eat it in front of your entire road arena. It's been Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And I just would like to throw his name in the hat, I guess, for being the number three guy behind Jokic and Embiid instead of Giannis. That's maybe all I'm trying to say here, because I mean, that guy had his game where he just didn't matter if it was Drew Holiday or Derek White or whoever. Like, the Celtics needed to throw everything at him, and Jason Tatum had to be the one to end up being on Shea at the end. He just has, I can't even think of him off the top of my head. There's been so many game winners and clutch buckets. Shout out Shea. And I think he is very much deserving to be a perennial top five MVP ballot dude until proven otherwise.
Yeah, the one thing I'll say to this, we talked about him quite a bit with Tyler Parker on Divine Intervention this week when we talked about the Thunder, but it's like 31-6-6 while leading the league in steals and deflections. Like, he's going to get all defense votes, and he should. So like, that kind of the overall offensive game with that defensive impact is, dare I say, like Jordan-esque, and something that we haven't necessarily seen from the top flight scoring and playmaking threats.
How dare you skip over Allen Iverson like that?
Okay, fair enough. I apologize. I mean, we're getting really Philly with this today, Jake. And I'm the guy who just voted for Embiid. But I mean, if Iverson was 6'6 and can guard every wing position.
He was scoring 30 and leading the league in steals. That's all I know.
Yeah, and well, yes, fair enough. Okay. Let me not damn SGA with faint praise by not comparing him to Allen Iverson, because I went for Jordan. Sorry. But yeah, like, you're absolutely right. I think we were all prepared for this to be like, well, there's just like the three, like, kaiju kind of like Godzilla, King Kong, Mothra, whatever, where it's like
the big bad bosses.
Yeah. Embiid and Jokic and Giannis. And then here comes Shai Gilgeous-Alexander being like, actually, you know, back the fuck up. Here I am too. So I think it's a completely defensible position. Our friend Tom Haberstroh had written, made a case for SGA as the number one MVP candidate a couple weeks ago. It wouldn't surprise me to see him wind up on some ballots there. Other names in that discussion, I think Luka Doncic probably wise is like more of your consistent fourth or fifth place guy. Giannis Antetokounmpo, again, like, just continue it to be special. And I would not be surprised to see Tyrese Haliburton show up on some MVP ballots. I think he's been that good offensively, and I think he's elevated that Pacers team into where they if they wind up with like a top four seed, he could wind up on some ballots there. So an embarrassment of riches in terms of talent at the top of the league. But for me, it's the big dude in Philly.
That is all we have for you today. That's all the awards talk we're going to give you, hopefully forever, but probably until
now. We're
going
to run it back next week. We're going to do like the 50-game MVP ballot.
I remain ever thankful that I've never been in the position to stress over the actual awards when money and stakes and legacies are on the line.
It's a bummer.
Good fortune.
It's a bummer
figuring that out. Happy birthday to super producer John Gennaro.
Yes.
Who does all the things to make this show look and sound great. Please subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube and whatever podcast platform you are currently listening on, and leave us a 5-star review. That would be very much appreciated. We thank you for listening, and we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cappers.